Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and once again, I'm joined by Cam Maitland and Alicia Fletcher, and this is the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I may be overstepping my bounds here, but to me, horror is a genre that I'd say the majority of people don't enjoy or watch on a regular basis. At least they say they don't. It's sort of relegated to October, where it's socially acceptable to watch a horror movie. But every now and then, something slips through the cracks for mainstream audiences, and it's labeled prestige horror. Think of like The Exorcist getting nominated for 10 Oscars in 1973, or more recent praise for movies like Babadook, Hereditary, or Midsommar. But what's one of the best ways to get your horror movie to a wider audience? Well, you can add subtitles. Non-English language horror has a pretty good track record of gaining attention from a wide audience, and the 2000s were a huge time for non-North American horror, due in part to the fact that Hollywood was remaking a ton of it, thank you Japan's Ringu, and foreign directors working in Hollywood, like Guillermo del Toro, were opening the doors for distribution for a number of their countrymen who were doing movies that, hey guys, you really need to see this. What's the first horror movie from outside North America you guys saw that you loved? Alicia, I know you're not a huge horror fan, but I'm sure there's something on your list.
I don't know. Can Cam answer first while sure. I contemplate this, despite having had days to contemplate it?
No, it's fine. I think thanks in large part, shout out to the Metro Cinema in Edmonton. They were very good at showing foreign releases. So I can't think of which was the first, but kind of around the 2000s, the big ones I remember are Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Cure and Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone are two of the kind of first big ones that really super affected me. Yeah, I just remember loving those. And from then on, I mean, I also remember the Drambuie Showcase Review. I really love Day of the Beast by Alex de la Iglesia. I've loved Spanish horror for a long time, which we'll get into. A lot of those films, and most public libraries, to be honest, have a lot of foreign horror. So if you're looking for horror in the public library, you're more likely to get it in the foreign section, because they don't really stock Texas Chainsaw Massacre as much as you might want.
Well, I think that helps me answer, because I think it's because Criterion Collection is so strong in its foreign horror section. So Criterion in the Janus Collection. So my first foreign horror experiences were definitely through, you know, I was just making my way when I was learning about film through every Criterion spine number I could get. And the two, like the one that's the earliest for me that I remember terrifying me was The Vanishing, which is a Dutch film from 1988, not a typical horror film. And then also anything by Guillermo del Toro. So coming back to what you're saying, Cam, with Spanish language, but certainly The Devil's Backbone was the one that, as someone who has a hard time with horror films, The Devil's Backbone was like, okay, I will be missing out on so much if I don't allow myself to watch foreign language horror films.
For me, I was living on Commercial Drive in my early 20s and with a bunch of stand-up comedians. And of course, none of us had any money whatsoever. So on Fridays, we would pool whatever change we had together. And we'd go to the video rental place around the corner that had like an unbelievable selection. And we'd pull like whatever looked the weirdest off the shelf. Either like it had a back cover that made us go, sorry, what? and so we found this movie called Suicide Club that's Japanese. And we put it on. And one of our roommates came home from work later, and we're all sitting there with like blankets up to our noses watching this thing. And he's like, it's a musical? And we're like, it wasn't until now. It is now. And that kind of started a whole thing for all of us. We're like, we got Quebecois horror. We were just seeing whatever we could get. And it's so great that that's now such a big distribution.
You're right. That it's the good era of weird Japanese horror happiness of the categories is another one. Yeah, Takeshi Miike, all those. Yeah.
Yeah, Ichi the Killer. Yeah. There's something so unpredictable about foreign horror because in North American English language culture, we have very specific things we're afraid of that we make movies about. And then you see what other cultures are scared of and they add their own folklore in. So think about something like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or Nosferatu. That's whole different ways of, like, even from the very beginnings of cinema, you're looking at scary stuff from other countries.
That's a great example. I am someone who specializes in German expressionism, so as much as I'm like, I don't like horror, I'm very, very much embroiled up in it. But do you think a lot of it too is because, and I think I experienced this when watching both of the films we're about to talk about, because you're reading subtitles, you can't turn away or you don't know what's happening. Because I'm someone, when I'm forced to watch a recent horror film, I have no qualms about covering my eyes. But when you do that with something that has dialogue in a foreign language, you don't know what they're saying.
I agree. I think you make an excellent point that, like, you can't look away. And often I find, like, some of them are just straight up gross and they're doing stuff that's kind of outside the boundaries of what we would deem acceptable. But a lot of it, too, is just so unusual in terms of its plotting. It's doing, especially Japanese stuff, really is all out of sequence, and it's doing stuff that we don't really consider narratively.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, they don't have to make a big budget studio film for Paramount the way that most of the horror films that we watch today do. So there's probably more freedom, certainly in, and I think also horror, going back to German expressionism, was always seen in film in other countries as an artistic endeavor. You know, graphic arts and all these things get tied into it in a way that didn't come until much later. You know, and something like horror in Hollywood, if you look at the 1930s, like Universal Films, they're just looking at the German expressionists. Like, they hadn't really developed their own sense of it yet.
Yeah, and I think it's much more precious in most countries. Like, it is not as mass-produced.
Yeah.
Maybe Japan gets close. I mean, we're talking about 2007, which is kind of the middle of the new extremity in France, which produced a lot. In most countries, as we'll get into, horror movies are a lot more rare and treated a lot more seriously because they're not this mass-produced product.
I think they also, at least from a North American perspective, they tend to get into prestigious film festivals like TIFF, like Sundance in the world section, and Telluride, and because it's like, well, it's a foreign film, it's artsy because it's in a foreign language, so we're going to put it in TIFF in a way that, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be marketed that way in its home country.
Mm-hmm. They also get nominated, as we're going to talk about. They get nominated for major awards in their own country in a way we don't nominate those films. So, I said, The Exorcist was the last horror movie. People thought that Hereditary was going to get in there, but it didn't.
People count Silence of the Lambs as an Oscar-winning horror movie, but it's a bit of a stretch.
Oh, man, I'm so glad you brought up Silence of the Lambs, because, like, I can see why people think it's a horror. I think it's more of a thriller, but it definitely falls into that final girl trope. And our first movie today also sits in that final girl kind of horror trope. And it's a really juicy final girl role for its lead, a Spanish actress and real-life TV news presenter, Manuela Velasco. The movie is a bottle episode, and it sparked a days-long debate in my household on the difference between stupid and panicking. The movie is Wreck, and we'll be spoiling the heck out of this one. It is impossible to discuss it and not spoil it. So if you haven't seen it and don't want to know what happens, go watch it. Come back. We'll wait. Alicia, you're making a face because we made you watch this for the first time. What did you think?
Oh, this is one of the scariest films I've ever seen. This equals so Wreck equals like when I saw The Exorcist at 12 years old at a sleepover, that first experience of seeing a very adult horror film. That I was really transported back to being a 13-year-old worried about peeing in my sleeping bag. That's really, despite being a mature woman many years later. I was impressed by how well done this was. I luckily knew very little going in, so I went in completely fresh, which is good. I didn't know that this had been remade into Quarantine, which actually I had seen and now understand. I really went in with fresh eyes, and it is so hyper-intensive and so frenetic, and so there's lots of jump scares, which I think I automatically disrespect horror films that rely on jump scares. I think it's cheap usually, but this masters them in a way that can only be done when you don't tell your actors what's about to happen and you throw
a la Alien.
Yeah, you throw a cadaver down like 7 flights of stairs and make and then record their reactions. Yeah, this is you know, takes place in Barcelona, and even like it takes place within an apartment building that's been completely boarded up because not boarded up, sorry, like I guess quarantined because there's an unknown virus that's going around. And I felt automatically like I'd stayed in this apartment building. Like it does a really good job of making you feel like anyone could be in this situation. Yeah, I thought I was going to pee myself. I watched it with my partner who has seen it, I think, a number of times and has seen the whole series because I believe there's 4 films.
There's 4
currently.
Of them, yes. They don't all have the same like found footage sort of thing. The first one and the second one do. The other two are more standard.
The third one
films.
Is half and half.
Yeah.
I gotcha. But he, you know, it was really late and he started to like fall asleep at what I would say is the climax of the scariest part of the film. And I was... normally I would just let him fall asleep because I don't care, but I was like completely nudging him and I was like, I need cognizance beside me in order for me to get through this film. And I did have nightmares. I had nightmares.
It was, sorry.
That's okay. I mean, I was as responsible in choosing to talk about this film as anyone. So
I think I'm the one who said like, oh, this is the year Wreck came out. We need to talk about Wreck.
Yes,
I think we paired our other film with this one.
Yeah, don't get me wrong.
It's just such an It's such a game changer, and it's such an important part of film history that I don't think a lot of people pay attention to, because this is the same year, 2007 is also the same year that Paranormal Activity came out. And so everybody remembers the Blair Witch Project, and everyone sort of falsely remembers that started the found footage horror boom, but it really didn't. The Blair Witch
later.
Came out, that came out, and like nothing happened, even though it's like an incredibly cheap way to make movies.
Well, I can tell you what happened. It's called Blair Witch 2 Book of Shadows, which no one liked and made no money.
Well, that's because it was more of a narrative film, wasn't it?
It wasn't found footage at all. But yeah, I think it's really a catch up of the technology, because this year you also have George Romero's Diary of the Dead, which is this reboot of his own series. And next year, but as early as possible, January, Cloverfield comes out,
which
I think from then on out, everybody wants to make one of these cheap, make a lot of money. I mean, Paranormal Activity, I think to this day, might be one of the most profitable films of all time. So, it's what gave us so much. What's his name? The guy who makes all the cheap movies that are horror.
Jason Blumhouse.
Yeah, so it gave us Blumhouse, which then gave us the latest Oscar-winning horror movie, Get Out. So I can trace it all back.
Well, it's also speaking to the fact that something really big happened in 2005, and that was the launch of YouTube. And so a lot of these filmmakers were starting to be like, oh, I can make stuff and then distribute it myself and put it out on there. It made it a whole new way that you could then look at how to make these films super cheap, super tight, and just get them out there. And I know the two filmmakers of Wreck looked at YouTube, and that's what kind of inspired them to make this, was what would happen if you just had a camera in one location and that it's just like a shotgun blast and it goes. And that's exactly what this film does.
Yeah, and even beyond that, Paco Plaza, one of the co-directors, this is a film that's co-written and co-directed, he said that he was just inspired looking at the different types of cameras. He said vintage footage on YouTube really inspired him just to think about that kind of handheld footage again, that they were not necessarily as inspired by the old found footage movies, which also, you know, you talk about Blair Witch, like Cannibal Holocaust is a found footage movie from the 70s. So those movies had kind of also always exist. We might talk about Man Bites Dog, one of my favorite found footage documentaries. I mean, I think it's really the technology catching up. The truth is Blair Witch was made cheaply, but it's made mostly on film cameras. And the digital photography was not quite cinema worthy till about this time. And also, if you think going forward, even up to Cloverfield, I believe, not a lot of these are the shot on phone yet, which I think really caused a boom. Once everyone was carrying around a little camera in their pocket, it made so much more sense. The justification of why somebody is filming in found footage makes so much more sense when everyone has a camera and every camera has a light and things like that. It is actually quite fascinating. A lot of people point to Wreck as an interesting time when phones weren't lights.
because otherwise the film would work.
Yeah, as you see. But yeah, it's a very unique time. I will also point, it's a very unique time in Spanish horror history. I'm going to go back, do my usual thing of being like, Spain was founded.
A lecture by Cameron Maitland. But,
we're going to go back to Columbus, the discovery. Yes. And,
You know what? Don't joke, because it does go back to that a bit. Spanish horror is a very unique genre. I think a lot of people think of Spanish language horror, but they are actually thinking quite often of Latin American and South mm-hmm. American horror because that was big alongside Hollywood's boom in the 30s and 40s. What's considered the golden age of Spanish horror is really the 60s, weirdly, because there were not a lot of Spanish horror movies since the silent era, essentially. There's a handful in the silent era, mm-hmm. kind of nothing. Then the golden era is also not movies that people necessarily love. It's just Franco. It's quite often films where they are bringing in other European actors or European directors to shoot in Spain, and it's quote unquote about Spain. So in the 90s, there is what is considered the new golden age of Spanish horror, which is what really both of these guys come out of, Jaume Velasco and Paco Plaza. And that's with movies like Dia de la Biesta, like we said, Alex de la Iglesia's film, which won a ton of Goya Awards. Alejandro Amenábar's Thesis, which is also kind of, again, a very seriously considered art film almost, but it's a horror movie. The Devil's Backbone, as we said, which is Guillermo del Toro, mm-hmm. who's from Mexico, but making a film about Spanish history. Mm-hmm. And so much of this is because of the fall of Franco. Like, the end of the terror in the 60s is kind of what allowed horror. And then, but horror really picked up because, drum roll, in 1992, because of these 500-year anniversary, one of the big things was Europe declaring Spain the cultural center of Europe, and it injected a lot of money, and a lot of these guys were suddenly able to have a lot more artistic freedom in the films they created.
Thank you, Christopher Columbus, i.e. Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't all Columbus, but it's that World's Fair Columbus, everything happening at once that we talked about in 1992. A lot of people really credit that.
Christopher Columbus
ability.
Is an icon in horror, if you want to.
Yes. That's true.
Absolutely. And if you want to get super theoretical, also, this era is when Prime Minister Zapatero was in charge. He was a very progressive socialist prime minister. He cared a lot about it. He had a cabinet that was 50-50 men and women, which is fairly unusual to this day in any country. And he also kind of got in trouble with the church because he didn't care so much about the Pope. So look out.
Well, I mean, that's interesting because this film also as well deals with religious themes, mm-hmm, even though it's still terrifying without the religious themes, which most movies that are about a religious issue, it's about that and how scary religion is. That's not what this is at all.
Oh, totally. Like, this is very easy to consume. It's kind of a thing you always have to grapple with Spanish horror, to me, is these movies are very easy to consume as fun horror movies.
Yeah.
They're very easy to consume as, like, face value. This is just like a roller coaster ride spook. It's like, I saw it at a film festival. I agree with Alicia. It's the scariest, probably one of the most frightening theatrical experiences I've had. Then it has all these layers. So every time a Spanish movie has a hint of fascism, like, write an exclamation mark. So the fact that these people are locked in by a government, the government doesn't tell them what to do, they are expected to follow orders no matter what is said, big deal. The fact that there is a religious cover-up by the Catholic Church,
the Vatican,
big deal. The fact, again, like you say, that this is a woman who's going against men, the fact that there's something that's as macho as the bombarderos. Quite often, the final girl means so much more in Spanish cinema because the fact that, like, machismo is such a big thing, that what they call in high-end theory the phallic failure of so many of these male characters. But this movie also just has what seems like relatively stereotypical touches of the Asian immigrants, the gay guy who's in the apartment building, but all of this is kind of a commentary on, like, oh, look at the new Spain. This is a very interesting melting pot, and some of it works, some of it doesn't. People are fighting against each other.
These are
when
people
they
that are in the
together.
Slums too, right? Like, it's a slum building. Yeah,
and it's like these people should be working together, but these kind of new divisions, which Spanish culture doesn't accommodate for, are really hurting them.
It's a slum building, but I have to say, as a resident of Toronto, as much as I was very connected to how scary this film was, I was admiring how tall the ceilings were and just how much space there was in the apartment.
It just lets the zombies get a bigger run-up to come get you, Alicia.
I'd be really scared. I'd be like, oh my God, what's in that corner? But then I'd also be like, that's a nice closet.
Yeah. Oh my God. I have to say that is a constant thing in Spanish movies where I never understand what is a crummy apartment. Jaume Balagueró has a very good other movie, which I would recommend any listener watch, called Sleep Tight, which is also about, like, a slumlord apartment owner who's a creep. But you're like, yeah, wait, these are bad apartments? My God, I want them. The beautiful tile work.
Yeah. Please come to Toronto, and the best apartment in Toronto is like a slum.
We would listen if I could I'd pay less than a grand to live with an evil possessed girl. Sign me up. Just keep her door locked.
Well, let's talk about how this is effective, because horror is much maligned, found footage even more so. Like, yeah, that's a subgenre that people are really not into. We've all said that this works. How does it work? Why is it so effective?
If you want a great theoretical one, I read by a critic named Randall Colburn. He points to the fact that it's relatively unusual in horror, and I think Alicia was talking about it too. It's unusual that you are a step behind.
Yeah.
Quite often, thrillers, stuff like Halloween and Jaws, is letting the audience in on what is going to happen. You see the shark's fin. You see Michael Myers in the background. You're going, no, don't go in there. But he says what is so scary about Wreck is the disorientation, that you are literally a step behind the characters. He compares it to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where it is so chaotic and crazy that as an audience, you are scared and you are also struggling to understand what is going on. And I think the way the story unfolds is even more ingenious, because at first you're like, okay, it's a crazy person. Okay, it's a zombie movie. Okay,
oh God, it's an
exorcism. Yeah. Okay, there's a horrible monster. And that's actually, as the Wreck series progresses, that even gets more and more, where it's like, okay, it's a Catholic conspiracy. Okay, do I side with the demon? Okay. Like, yeah. And I think that works so well. And I also think it's the reality again. Like you say, Manuela Velasco is a real reporter. So she seems so real. I mean, I think this also has a deep commentary on sensationalistic journalism in Spain, which Thesis is also about a lot. Just like, you know, ambulance chasing violence. But, yeah, I think you're just so thrown in. But the fact that so many of these scares, the film was not improvised, but it was essentially handed to the people as it happened.
Yeah, and they didn't have an idea of what their characters would be subjected to. They weren't sure what day they were going to die or how they were going
to
die.
They were just told, hey, just try to survive. That was their motivation, just try to survive.
Which I think makes the characters probably more realistic, because these people were trying to deeply embody these characters. And I think it makes some of the scares so brutal. Like, for instance, I mean, the most famous sequence, I think it's even in the trailer, is when Manuela Velasco is being seen through the night vision camera, and she can't see what's going on. And she did not know what was in the room. She actually could not see.
It was in the dark.
She actually did not know that there was a monster person in the room with her.
It's also like the poster is her in night vision. So for me, part of why this is so scary is the effectiveness of her performance. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, Cam and Becky too, that she was a newscaster and like a TV presenter. I didn't realize, because I recognized her and I was like, I mean, obviously I do not watch Spanish television that often. I've been to Spain a number of times, but not in a way that I would recognize a TV presenter. And then I realized she's the little girl in Almodóvar's Law of Desire from 1987.
Oh.
So her, like, so as much as like she is a newscaster and she's a TV presenter, her history in Spanish film is like very prestigious going back to the 1980s when she would have been very young. Like, I think she's maybe 12 or something like that in Law of Desire.
I think something that also really works for me, because the found footage, like 90% of your job is like, why aren't these people just putting the camera down and running? Like that's the biggest obstacle you have to overcome. And with this one, what's so great about it is it's because she's a professional and she's there to get the shot. She's going to get it done. And she keeps screaming at them, film everything. Yeah. And she's professional until she absolutely cannot be anymore. And that speaks to her performance as well, that you believe she is this, like, I'm getting out of this terrible thing where I have to follow people around after dark. I want normal daylight hours. I want a better job. Yeah. And that's her motivation, right?
Yeah, she wants the good story. And then the fact that I think it also matters that they are turning the story into a good story. It goes from just a good kind of ambulance chasing story, as I say, to a story where she thinks she's uncovering this government corruption, and then maybe it's Catholic corruption, and it gets bigger and bigger. And like you say, Becky, this is a film, she won the Goya Award for Best New Actress, so it was recognized, and we are not alone. It is not a mistranslation.
It's also what you see, right? Because this is shot so beautifully, and you don't see anything you're not supposed to see until it's way too late. And part of that is the fact that the cinematographer is the dude behind the camera the entire time.
You never meet him. Effective. You hear his voice and we know his name. And beyond that, like, his death is in some ways the most brutal, because he's her only lifeline and the only way that she can really see is through the camera. But also, like, We don't even know what he looks like or what his deal is. Like, he was her best hope, and he's just, when that camera hits the ground, you're like, what are we going to do now?
And I want to just talk quickly about expectations, because this is the part that, like, really created a massive debate in my household. This film is now off limits for discussing, is because the death of Manu, who's the firefighter, who is also, like, you know, the champion, is set up to be, like, the man who's going to make everything better. He dies without announcement, without ceremony. He just pops out, and you know he's gone, and now he's a zombie. And and there, everybody's alone. And my partner got so mad at that, because he's like, but he was such a big part of the movie. Why didn't he get a hero's death? It really upset
life.
Him.
That's life, yeah. Becky's partner.
Thank you. That's what I'm trying to tell him.
Like, 2020.
It's effective because of this. You're not understanding.
It's funny because part of me wants to say, you should watch the rest of the series with him. And part of me is like, maybe this might just be digging the hole deeper.
My relationship needs to survive this podcast, guys.
It's interesting that we've been talking about this film for, like, you know, 20 odd minutes. And this is the first time the word zombie came up. Because I really had to sit down and think, like, is this a zombie film? It's definitely not a traditional zombie film. It is a zombie film, I think. It's a virus, you know, it's in a way that zombie films in the 2000s, especially with George A. Romero, you know, this idea of virus equals zombieism. While I was watching it just the other night, I waited as long as I could to watch this film before having to do it. You're talking about this virus, and we're going to talk about it again with our next film. It's something in 2020. It's something to have a horror film that is so scary about a virus that you cannot control, and you start quarantining people, and people are getting experimented on, and there's a government conspiracy. Like, I'm having a hard time watching these films this week.
I will also say that there's a lot of people point, when you talk about the zombie film, people point to this one as a very interesting mix of the Romero zombie and the pre-Romero zombie, because this returns the zombie to religious implications.
It's true. It also,
to, like, the voodoo roots.
Yeah, that's true. It also incorporates kind of the 28 days later zombie of, they run and they can take stairs way faster than you.
And they make a horrible screeching sound, so they're loud, too.
Yeah.
And my memory of two is less set, but I also think that these ones are nearly impossible to kill. Like, I think you can take their head off and they don't actually die.
Oh,
they just keep coming at you.
Well, just quickly, we should talk about the monster, because the monster is one of those ones. Unlike the movie we're next going to be talking about, where you get to see a lot of the monster, this one, it's very minimal. You don't even know there is a big bad until all of a sudden they're in the room. Cam, you've got a little bit about this actor.
I really love this guy. This is a creature performer. It's really kind of his breakout creature. People probably know him from Mama, mostly. His name is Javier Botet. He's essentially like kind of the next Doug Jones, though he and Doug Jones happily work together all the time when you need a big guy. So Javier Botet has Marfan syndrome, which is quite often what I think a lot of scary monsters these days are trying to ape. He is 6'7" and 120 pounds. To give you an idea of what he looks like. Marfan syndrome affects a lot of your connective tissue, but what it ends up giving you is, one thing is incredibly long fingers, just fingers that are out of control. He's also, like, he's in It, he's in The Conjuring, he's pretty much in everything now. If you see a very long, skinny monster, Guillermo del Toro happily pairs him and Doug Jones all the time. Crimson Peak, he's a lot of the monsters.
I think I recognize him from Crimson Peak, which is a film I love. Yeah.
And actually, he shows up quite a bit in Spanish film, not as a creature as well. He's quite fun in Witching and Bitching, if you've seen that movie.
I have.
He just plays
a guy.
That's He's the guy that's chained up in the basement. Yeah, when you see this monster, it is so surreal. And you're like, oh God, what kind of special effect created this? And the truth is, it's pretty basic makeup effects and just what his body
looks
like.
And the night vision, too, because we're only experiencing the monster through the lens of the camera in night vision, which is so effective.
Which I also believe is one of the first uses of that for horror in that way. You hadn't really seen it before.
Yeah, and it's a very fascinating role. He also actually frequently, I think like Doug Jones, frequently plays women, and this is a female character. Mm-hmm. Which I think is very interesting, just their ability to sort of do that. And I think he's somebody who is committed himself very hard to his craft, and that's why he's very quickly risen somebody that looks unique. I mean, Doug Jones's whole thing was that he was a contortionist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He could fit inside the Mac Tonight outfit, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. His big break with Mac Tonight, Javier Botet was naked crazy woman who's possessed by the devil. But yeah, it's an amazing performance, and he's somebody to really look out for, because I love, as much as I love Doug Jones, I think Guillermo del Toro unfortunately kind of drove him into the ground. His performance style. So I think when him and Javier Botet can play off each other, it's really great. I know that they filmed a Star Trek Discovery together. I've never seen it, but I was like, oh, they're together.
Go like watch Crimson Peak. Please go watch. This is your go watch Crimson
Peak
reminder.
Has both of them as well, playing different monsters. And yeah, it just, I love creature performers, and there's not a ton of them. So it's very interesting. And it's interesting to see somebody use their abilities. You know, he's hired for his disability. And he uses it wonderfully and has grown to become this great performer.
All right. Well, as we're talking about monsters, I think that fits beautifully into our next film, because it is all about different kinds of monsters. Now, Bong Joon-ho is a name that until 2019, I'm sure a lot of people hadn't heard before. And then suddenly his movie was responsible for the first ever foreign language film winning the Best Picture category at the Oscars. That movie was Parasite. And if it didn't make him a household name, his work certainly got a lot of people wondering what else they were missing from around the world. Well, back in 2007, Bong Joon-ho broke records in his native South Korea as well with a movie that was at the time the highest grossing Korean film ever. Fortunately, it got a North American theatrical release, and I actually saw this one in the theater with four other people, two of them whom I dragged with me. And there was actually confusion when I tried to buy the ticket at the box office, because the ticket seller instead sold us a ticket for Richard Gere's The Hoax and was completely unsure as to why we would even want to bother going to see a movie from Korea. And it's the closest I think I've ever gotten to calling someone a Philistine.
I can't believe that's the closest you've gotten, Becky. You've called plenty of people Philistine.
Not with the full intention behind it. That having been said, this movie, the minute I saw it, entered my top 10 of favorite movies I've seen. Guys, I love 2007. Let's talk about The Host.
Yeah, The Host is, I mean, it's a monster film, and Bong Joon-ho, I believe it's his third film. Most notably in 2003, he produced or directed Memories of Murder, which was a huge hit. And that's what kind of led to The Host being so well received. I think of it as like a big budget film. It's not. It was made for $10 million, which is unbelievable. What's so different about the host, and in its Korean title translates very literally to monster. So it's an interesting kind of translation trick where like The Host to me means something very different than monster, but I'm curious what you guys think about the title. It does what most monster films, I would say all monster films, and especially Wreck, do not, which is it shows the monster in its full form, in this case in daylight, I think 12 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
So there isn't that, Cam, the way you're talking about Wreck and why it's so effective is that, you know, it's not like Jaws where you've seen the shark early on and you have to like, no one else has seen it and like the audience is in on it. We're just with all the characters of the film because they all see the monster right away. And it makes it so much scarier. And the monster is produced by the special effects house Weta. Weta's new from New Zealand, right?
It's the Peter Jackson related.
And done really, really well. It's got this crazy mouth and a prehensile tail. And it's just like, it makes no sense. And it's kind of a fish. We are led as viewers to know what's going on. And this is based on a real incident in 2000 where the American military who were stationed in South Korea flushed large quantities of formaldehyde down the drains, which led into the Han River in Seoul and created a lot of pollution. And there was a lot of awareness of potentially fish mutations. So the film opens with that. So we kind of get a sense of like, well, first of all, this film is, you know, it's about a mutated monster. But we also are made very well aware right from the beginning by Bong Joon-ho that this is the U.S.'s fault. This is an issue of imperialism and international intervention. And he really bases this monster film, which all good monster films do, on actual politics. So as a Canadian-American watching it, in 2007, because it is a 2006 film in South Korea, but is released in North America in March of 2007. As someone watching it then, I wasn't really aware of these real incidents. I wasn't really interpreting what this meant about international intervention. I was just so scared of this monster. And the main character who is attacked by this monster and kept in a sewer is a little girl. And it's up to her family, her father, her grandfather, her aunt, and her uncle to save her, because they know she's alive because she has her cell phone. When the animal swallows, when the monster swallows her and dumps her in the sewer, she's able to call them. So they all think she's dead. And eventually it's all about this kind of, and of course the father, if you've seen Parasite, is played by Song Kang-ho, who is, I think, now probably the most iconic actor in South Korea. Yeah. And he's played as this kind of stoner, bleach blonde, not too bright, single dad. But obviously the parenting of his daughter is done a lot by his sister and his father.
But she's still everything to him. Like the stakes when she goes missing are so high.
Yes, this is such an incredible role for him. It's such a great father-daughter film. This would great Father's Day screening. My warped brain goes, but
he starts as a father, he ends as a father, just not as the same child.
It's true. And the government, you know, the government really is the villain in this. It's not necessarily the monster, which in producing the host, they nicknamed the monster Steve Buscemi, because it reminded it reminded them so much of the just blind evilness of Steve Buscemi's character in Fargo, which I think is really funny.
Well, he's an animal. And you talking about him being like us seeing him right away, the big thing that's so scary about it is that things unfold about it later. Like there's it's such a complicated character that you're like, oh, it can do that. Oh, shit, it can do that. And they don't know about that, and unfolds for you in the same time.
Yeah. And so it is really about a family that are, it's a dysfunctional family, much like Parasite. It sounds so corny, but coming together to like, and also to recognize each other's, that the criticisms they have about each other are actually going to end up being their strengths, which I thought was really interesting. The aunt is an interesting character played by Duna Bay, who she's an archer, but she in the beginning of the film, she's just not good enough, so she gets a bronze medal. And her storyline, her arc in this film, I think is one of my favorites. But you know, it's there's currently a statue of Steve Buscemi on the Han River that I think was erected maybe 4 or 5 years ago. So this is like a real cultural touch point for the South Korean film industry. But also this monster means something to them that I think it's hard for us to understand.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's again, we talk about the serious like award winner. The Blue Dragon Awards are essentially the Oscars of South Korea, and it's Best Picture. This monster movie was Best Picture. Yeah.
And we should also say that the North Koreans also really liked this movie because it's very anti-American. Like, it really was a big unifier.
And I mean, also, when you ask Bong Joon-ho if it's super anti-American, he's like, my big problem is that Korea lets this happen.
Yeah.
It's, like it's one thing that America's bad, but my real problem is with Korea.
Yeah.
Because, you let it all happen.
Something you need to know about Bong Joon-ho is he was also a student protester. So in 1997, there was a massive economic crash in which brought down their whole government, and there was massive student protests, which then went into their current era where they're now a democracy. But he was very much part of that. So what you're seeing in that that moment where they're all getting sprayed with like the Agent Orange, Agent Yellow, that was what they were doing to protesters at the time.
Yeah.
Looking at the stuff from Spain, same thing. People would have looked at this and been like, oh, yeah, 100%. I know what that is.
Of all the genres, I feel like understanding the politics of the country that made it is more important in horror than many others. There's just something about horror that, or at least good horror, the kinds of films we're talking about that play festivals, that will always use what is decrepit and very unfortunate in their political circumstances. They will always turn that into an analogy or a metaphor or a character called Steve Buscemi. And it's, but this is the kind of horror that I can do, unlike Rec, because it has such a fantasy base. And then I get even more scared when I realize it's about actual political movements that occurred. I think you could show this to a 12 or 13-year-old, especially because two of the protagonists are school-age children. And I think it could go over quite well.
And this is a very funny movie, as scary as
it is.
Yeah,
he loves comedy. It's hilarious. I was going to say, I think almost all his movies have significant comedic part, and that's why people are like, eh?
It's disarming. He disarms us with comedy, and then he really actually makes a very scary film.
Yeah, because even like Memories of Murder and Mother, which are both fairly serious films, are fairly comedic throughout, which is...
I think one of the complications with talking about Bong Joon-ho writing about Bong Joon-ho, although people have done it very well, especially recently, is he is so humble as a person. Mm. It's annoying how humble he is. And Cam and I went to the Independent Spirit Awards this past, well, in the before times, let's just say. Yes. It was like February, where you could actually still travel. And of course, he won big time for Parasite. And like, being in the awards tent and all of his, you know, acceptance speeches and his award and his speeches to press, he gave them nothing, which I really appreciate. He took the time to essentially promote other up and coming South Korean filmmakers, including his interpreter, who is a filmmaker. Like he doesn't really talk a lot about his films. He makes them and he walks away. And I think that that's something that I find very appealing in him, actually.
But it's very similar to Guillermo del Toro in the way that yes. he's very, very done a great job of kicking the door open thing. We didn't talk about it in Rec, but Guillermo del Toro in 2007 introduced the film The Orphanage in El Orfanto, which mm-hmm. is also mm-hmm. a phenomenal film and totally worth the time.
That's so scary. That one scared me too much. I was going to pee my sleeping bag then, too. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, man. But this one, I think the other thing, like, the more you understand and, like, take the time to understand Korean history and, like, the little nuances that unless you, like, really know about, like, what the word Han actually means, you're not going to get some of the symbolism. So Han is based on a Chinese character, which it's a podcast, so I can't show you. But it means, like, resentment, hatred, regret. But there's also an element of hope. So the fact that the monster comes out of the Han River is, like, a big symbolic thing. It's really interesting.
This was also, I think, really, there's some sets, but mostly this was filmed in real sewers around the Han River. And I found that very effective and then was very disturbed to learn that all the cast and crew had to be inoculated for tetanus and various bacterial disorders. Like, that's scary.
That's commitment, scary. Alicia. That's called commitment.
Yeah. I love the fact when we talk about the weird ways he deflates the genre, I love the fact that you spend so much time with his family and understanding each of them and their quirks. And yet at the end, a random homeless guy who's bored does almost as much. Like, he just goes like, hey, I'll come along. I got nothing to do.
That's a great character.
He does almost more heroic stuff than anyone else, which I think is probably a little tip of the hat to the class stuff that Bong Joon-ho loves. I think that this is a movie that just, if you love his other films, and you haven't seen this, it's worth seeking out.
I have to admit that I was surprised that Parasite was the one that really broke through, because as much as I love Parasite, don't get me wrong, I think it's great, but I think this and Memories of Murder are both really effective in a way Parasite may not necessarily be.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like with this being coming after Snowpiercer, or Parasite coming after Snowpiercer and Okja, I feel like, and the can backing on Parasite, it's just like, it was just time.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
the host is as effective, like you say, or more effective than Parasite. It's just they weren't ready. We weren't ready yet for him to be on a tour or like one of our most important directors.
Yeah. I also think that there's a level of subtlety that comes and goes in his works.
Sure.
I don't love Snowpiercer, for instance.
I do not
feel
either.
Like it's really hammering you on the head with its message.
Yeah.
And I actually think that the host, partially like what we're talking about, I think it took quite a lot of research on my part to even get at all what it was about. Mm-hmm. Whereas Parasite, I think, is a much more like gut feeling. And just, you know, coincidentally, the class struggle in Korea mirrors quite a lot of North America's.
Yeah. It's
so
a timing
I think
issue.
That helps.
There is also a lot of in Korean stuff. If you watch Korean dramas like I do, and I absolutely love them, there's a lot of like these extremely heightened moments that are like just normal for them that we don't do. For example, when they're mourning when they think the little girl is when they're mourning, they're all just laying on the ground and rolling around.
I think that that actually really took me out of it when I first. I also went to in theaters because it was so critically acclaimed. I didn't know much about Bong Joon-ho at the time, but I didn't really connect with his filmmaking until Mother, I will say, and partially I think because I knew that I was so far away. Like, obviously, the moment where they're mourning is meant to be a comedic moment, but. You know, in North America, a huge display of emotion when your child has just been consumed by a monster is not unusual.
By Steve Buscemi specifically.
Yeah. So, I mean, his brother drop kicks him. That's funny. But the fact that Song Kang-ho is crying like a maniac is meant to be funny because he's so far out of the norm of Korean mourning. That so it's like I could tell that I'm like, ooh, I'm not on the wavelength of this movie. So I think it took something a little more straightforward, like Mother or Parasite, maybe for the average person to get on board.
You know what I learned a lot about from this film? South Korean snacks. because they run a snack stand, and I love that stuff. Chips and weird things, like not
South
weird things
Korea
to us, but
films food in a way I have never seen any other culture film food. They have a show called Let's Eat, which is simultaneously a romantic comedy, a serial killer drama, and a like food porn show where they like do these loving close-ups of like whatever they're eating, and they like breathe out all sexily like food as they like consume it. It's the weirdest thing, but it's also wonderful. They shoot food like nobody else.
I understand this line of thinking.
No film will make you want an ice cold height beer quite like The Host.
I think that's the perfect place to go into our next segment, guys. So when we come back, what curmudgeonly musical theater composer made the proposed lead actress to a movie adaptation of his work send 12 audition tapes before he allowed the movie to be made? We're going to find out about that and a whole bunch of dancing after the break. In the A Year in Film series, we know that the historical context in which movies are made matters. And you can't argue that one of the biggest influences into North American culture, be it from the lives it affected and cut short to the fictional movies made about their reign of terror, is Charles Manson and the Manson family. Now, if you're like me and you are, number one, a nerd for true crime, and number two, fascinated by how a group of individuals could affect culture so deeply, check out the definitive six-part docuseries Helter Skelter, An American Myth, and Hollywood Suite is the only place you're going to be able to catch it in Canada. Part one airs February 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and every Thursday until the season finale on March 18th. And the episodes drop on demand the day after the premiere. So if you're listening to this podcast in the future, the whole series may just be available to binge right now. That's Helter Skelter, An American Myth, starting February 11th to give new context to the way you watch movies.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Up there with controversial film genres is the movie musical. It was once a staple of Hollywood from, let's say, the 30s to the 60s, although obviously they've kept producing movie musicals since then. But musicals recently have very much fallen off. In fact, in the 2000s, by my count, Hollywood has only made 15 big-budget movie musicals. Broadway, however, keeps going. And every now and then, they inspire Hollywood to take another fistful of money swipe at the box office smash prize. Alicia, let's go all the way back and talk about the concept of the movie musical, what makes an effective movie musical, and what was going on in 2007 that like a dozen of those 15 were released.
Yeah, it's really shocking that that many musicals were released in 2007. But, you know, if we're going to talk about, and very briefly, I mean, there's very long tomes written on the history of musicals. We are not going to go into everything.
Busby Berkeley was born in 19...
Yeah, and it even kind of predates Busby Berkeley in some ways. But, you know, as soon as sound became, I don't want to say invented, because we know sound in film was invented way before sound film became popularized. But, you know, if you look at The Jazz Singer or whatever, which most people quote as the first sound film, which it 100% wasn't, it's 1927, you start to see the idea of like the musical as a genre, it becomes the most important genre to sell sound on film. So of course, as soon as like 1929 and into the 30s, musicals are hugely appealing because it's demonstrating the new technology. And so you get this grandiosity that really is, you can't compare, especially with studios like MGM and Paramount. But the thing to keep in mind with the 1930s and why musicals are so important is the Depression. Mm. Musicals, as they were kind of conceived in the beginning, were about escapism. The people who were going to spend pretty much all the disposable income that they had to go see a movie were most likely impoverished and really looking for a way to sit down in a movie theater and just escape the drudgery that was the Great Depression.
Well, I mean, that would be why Shirley Temple was like the biggest box office star at the age of what, like 6, 7?
Yeah, or even I think starting at 5 years old. Yeah, that's a very good point. And so it kind of gets morphed a little bit because as North America comes out of its economic depression with the start of World War II, you know, musicals are very much there in the 40s, but they become kind of like more wartime musicals, a little bit more vested in, they're still escapists though. They're still kind of making world war glamorous and making the Navy glamorous. And that goes all the way into the 1950s. And then frankly, that kind of escapism just doesn't work anymore in the 50s and into the 60s, and the studio system in Hollywood and censorship starts breaking. And so really, when you see the first resurgence of musicals, it's the 1970s where everything becomes like subversive musicals. Mm. So think about like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which has come up a number of times. Grease, like, and even Grease is looking back at the 1950s and one of the golden ages of musicals.
Well, I was surprised to see how late Hair came out. It's 1979. Yeah. I was like, wasn't that like 65, 66? Nope, 79.
Yeah, and something like Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise is a really good example of how the 70s interpreted musicals. In some ways, they're almost anti-musicals. And by the 80s and 90s, I mean, really, the genre is just dead. Hmm. Like, there's throwbacks, like Woody Allen, of course, has Everybody Says I Love You. It's really not until like 2007, maybe a year or two before that, where the musical as conceived in the 40s, the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s kind of returns with huge blockbusters, giant dance sequences, elaborate sets. It's no longer a midnight movie the way Phantom of the Paradise and Rocky Horror Picture Show were. They become glossy again. I think that's what happens in 2007 is the gloss is added back to the musical genre.
It seems like that's a budgetary thing. Like to make a musical, you need to have obviously people who can sing and dance and act in front of a camera and hit their mark. Like it's not like a Broadway show where like you have this large canvas. Like you have to kind of know exactly what you're shooting, when and where with a budget. And 2007 is like when we start to really see digital filmmaking. So you wouldn't have to set up for like take after take after take if one dancer has to like start again. Like it makes sense that you would be able to kind of try to reinvent that genre again just because of the cost cutting?
Yeah, you're not seeing the same, you're totally right. You're not seeing the same like elaborate 100 person chorus line, Busby Berkeley, woman jumps out of a cake scenario. It is, I guess there's more flexibility, but it's also interesting because, and I'm glad you brought it up, this idea of like, and we're going to talk about two films that cast actors that are not known as singers. I mean, Johnny Depp is not known as a singer, obviously, but the idea of like the original star from the 1930s, you had to do it all.
Yeah.
You had to dance, you had to sing, you had to act. Like it was very rare for someone like, look at someone like Joan Crawford. I mean, Barbara Stanwyck, like they're all dancers. They're all singers too.
Yeah. And you were meant to be this like multi-hyphenate that there just isn't that expectation of. And especially like when you look at in the 60s, the dubbing over of voices, like why didn't you just cast Julie Andrews in My Fair Lady? Why is it Audrey Hepburn? Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a cachet in 2007 of, you know, we'll all like line up at the box office to see what they sound like singing. I mean, look at something like Les Mis or Cats. Like, I'm hoping we don't bring up Cats.
It'll only be you.
We're definitely going to bring up Les Mis once.
Yeah. It'll only be me. I brought up was it last episode where we talked about there was a better cockroach singing and dancing cockroach sequence?
Obviously, like one of the big things that started the 2007 boom was that Chicago came out and just knocked everybody on their feet. But that's another one where it's singing and dancing, but it's a relatively small cast.
Well, it's true. And it's interesting as you're bringing up then Bob Fosse, you know, Fosse obviously was dead by the time this edition of Chicago was produced. It's directed by Rob Marshall, right?
Yeah.
You know, Fosse's huge in the 70s. Like that's an era of musical that's very, very focused more so, I would say, on dance and choreography than the music, although the music's fantastic and in something like Cabaret. Mm-hmm. But that's a subversive musical as well. Yeah. It's about Nazis and homosexuality and taking place in Weimar Germany. So once Fosse passes in the 80s and you get a lot of those really iconic choreographers who were making film adaptations of very famous musicals, when they pass away, I think it is another sign of why the musical disappears.
And so you don't have these strong voices. Well, that leads us perfectly, I think, into our first film for today. When people hear the name Stephen Sondheim, he's known for a lot of things. He's known for highly trained professional singers being challenged by his music. He is famously picky about his work being adapted, and he likes to write jaunty tunes about intensely dark subjects. Aside from the movie we're talking today, he also has a musical called Assassins about different assassins throughout history, all singing at Lee Harvey Oswald trying to get him to kill the president. That's a musical that exists.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Great.
So it and actually has some
would
great
never
tunes
be a good
it.
Movie, though. It's one of those.
No.
I disagree. I'm going to option it tomorrow.
There's literally a song that goes, "If you want to kill a president." Yeah. And there's, yeah, it's something, let me tell you.
I think that could be quite timely.
Well, it makes sense that this is the kind of thing Tim Burton would be associated with. So we're going to talk about Sweeney Todd today and actors who may not have been the best choices for this role. Although, Cam, you like this movie more than Alicia and I do.
Oh, yeah. I think it's starting off. I mean, it's important to say that part of the, like, Chicago made so much money. It was the highest grossing movie musical of all time for a long time. Till Mamma Mia, really. People count Alvin and the Chipmunks. I don't.
Well, then you gotta count, like, Disney stuff. Like, that's
just
not...
Yeah. So that was a huge deal. And the fact that they'd been sitting on Chicago for decades. So there was, even though it was a trickle kind of between Chicago, I mean, Chicago also got Best Picture, but between Chicago and Sweeney Todd, you saw Phantom of the Opera and Dreamgirls, like essentially all these older musical properties, people realizing, like, oh, we're sitting on cash here. So Sweeney Todd, I feel like last time, the past couple episodes, I maybe wasn't so good at recapping the movie. So if you don't know about Sweeney Todd, he's a barber who kills people. they are baked into meat pies by his landlady. That's about the gist. It is
wow. That's a great summary. Yeah.
He's not wrong. It's 3 hours of that.
Yeah. It's an urban legend, like really a Penny Dreadful story from the 1800s, first made into a play in 1847. Sondheim saw a 1973 version of the story and then adapted it into a musical in 1979. Then, you know, smash cut to a young art student in London named Tim Burton.
Timothy Burton at the time, actually.
Yeah,
yes.
wasn't much into musicals, but he saw a poster for Sweeney Todd and was like, whoa. he went to Sweeney Todd, super loved it. And then around 1987, it sounds like, when he was starting to become a famous director, he approached Stephen Sondheim and said, I would like to make this a musical. Sondheim said he really loved his pitch, partially because Stephen Sondheim weirdly does not like movie musicals. He thinks that musicals are not really suited to movies.
What you accept on the stage, which is the action will stop dead in its track while somebody warbles at you for 4.5 minutes. In the movies, it just stops dead, as far as I'm concerned. So you have to not just adapt the show, you have to transform it.
Like, he's a guy who's written screenplays for non-musical films.
Does he like the paychecks?
But also, you know what?
You think he likes movie musicals?
He's also got that sweet high school production money rolling in, so,
yes.
You know.
Oh, yeah. He's richer than God by the 1970s already, so he doesn't really care. But I will say that he dislikes openly many adaptations of his work, from West Side Story to Carousel, yeah, all those. He doesn't really like them, and nowadays he's quite picky. But anyway, Tim Burton said approached him, and two things he said that he liked was Tim Burton said that it was like a film melodrama more than a musical, and also Tim Burton described it as a silent film with music, which
it's very interesting because this was a silent film. The first film adaptation of Sweeney Todd is 1926. It's a lost film that was only 15 minutes, but then they remake it again in 1928 in a full-length version. And that version does survive. It is minorly accessible in that someone has a rip of it and then have put a camera in front of their very square television on YouTube. So you can kind of watch it. But, you know, I'm really curious to see this 1928, obviously non-musical version, which I believe was British.
Oh, probably. It's a thing that's been adapted a million times in the UK, I think. Anyway, so Tim Burton approaches him in 1987. Then Stephen Sondheim says, like, and then I never saw him again. he got very excited for this idea. Then cut to, like, almost 20 years later, director Sam Mendes is doing a stage version of Gypsy. And I think this is post-Chicago. And Sam Mendes goes, like, hey, has anybody adapted Sweeney Todd or approached you about that? And he's like, well, I thought Tim Burton was, but you can go nuts if you want. So Sam Mendes brings on playwright John Logan, who has been a screenwriter for a while. But the interesting thing is he was really known. His first plays were adaptations of true crime stories, Leopold and Loeb and the Lindbergh kidnappings. Mm-hmm. So he's a guy who loves true crime. We know later he loves gothic horror because he created Penny Dreadful.
Mm. I love that show.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's why you don't love Sweeney Todd? I don't
know. No, it's a spoiler alert. I'm going to change what I said yesterday in prepping the podcast and say that I like it.
Well, hopefully we can, and I can turn Becky around too by the end of this. Sam Mendes, I don't know. Do you want to get into it now, Becky? Sam Mendes had some casting decisions that I know you think are crazy.
Let's do this. So I genuinely do not get. So I understand needing to have big stars. Like, I get it 100%. Yes. You got a movie musical, you got to have it. Why, for the love of God, in the 2000s, were they so obsessed with casting Russell Crowe and Anne Hathaway in singing parts? So they were both attached to this film before Les Mis was even conceived. And so was Hugh Jackman. Hugh Jackman makes sense. He's actually a musical performer. Yeah. I get it. But Anne Hathaway and Russell Crowe, like, why Russell Crowe?
I blame
the Illuminati.
My understanding is also that Russell Crowe is, I think, Sam Mendes. But I think Anne Hathaway almost made it through the Tim Burton as well, but he decided he'd prefer Joanna to be an unknown actress.
That was exactly it. Well, because he had such big stars in the other roles, and also one of them being his girlfriend / partner at the time.
Yes.
Helena Carter.
Yeah. So anyway, this all happens. Sam Mendes actually gets frustrated with the casting process. He can't get the people he wants. He bails. I think by that point, the ball is rolling so hard that the producers are like, is there any other director? And Stephen Sondheim's like, I've been telling you, Tim Burton.
Tim Burton.
He's like, Tim Burton gave me a great pitch 20 years ago. So they come to Tim Burton. Tim Burton goes, yeah, you know what? I'll do it. But Johnny Depp's got to be Sweeney Todd. They go to Johnny Depp.
That makes sense.
Johnny Depp goes, no.
Okay, what I love is that no one asked Johnny Depp if he could sing until way further into the process. And then they were like, everything was signed. They were about to shoot. Yeah. And they were like, can you sing? And he was like, I don't know.
He luckily went to the woodshed. Because I also thought, I was like, oh, Johnny Depp's in a band. Johnny Depp plays guitar in the band.
That's right.
Johnny Depp
like
does not sing.
20 years prior to this.
And can we talk about just briefly, because I don't know if we're going to get another chance to do this, that Johnny Depp has always wanted to be a rock star more than an actor. And it was having a beer with his buddy, Nicolas Cage, who was like, you should try out this acting thing. You know, it's easy money because you're pretty.
Beautiful.
And sure enough, it was. Go ahead, Cam.
Oh, yeah. Well, so that's the funny thing to me is I think quite often you think of Tim Burton and Johnny Depp and they're like, hell yeah. But this is the one time where Tim Burton's like, I won't do it without Johnny Depp. And Johnny Depp was like, maybe. And then the interesting thing is, as you say, his wife at the time, which I don't even know, they don't even bring up if Tim Burton was fully aware of this, because he was not pushing. He liked Sweeney Todd on his own. But Helena Bonham Carter had seen Sweeney Todd when she was 11 and says as a child, she dressed up as Mrs. Lovett.
Oh,
and
God.
Unlike Johnny Depp, she was absolutely obsessed with the role of Mrs. Lovett.
It's such an iconic role for her.
It's
such a great role for women, too. Like, such a great role. And you think about the women who've gotten to play. Like, it was originated by Angela Lansbury. There's a stage version that was filmed of that and her, Len Carreyrou, doing it. And it is amazing.
Yeah. And recently, it's worth saying that Sweeney Todd was a bit hot again at the time, because there was a fairly lauded performance with Patti LuPone and Michael Severus that was a very interesting. Again, Sondheim is kind of a weird guy to adapt because his plays are quite often black box-ish sort of musicals. Mm-hmm. And this Sweeney Todd, the interesting thing was everyone who was not Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd was the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
They were all playing the instruments. You can find a pretty good medley from the Tony Awards.
I think around this time, there was also a lot more interest in North America in meat pies. Like, that's really where I can remember, sure, like, all the meat pie shops kind of, you know, on Queen Street and stuff here in Toronto, like, showing up around, like, 2004.
It was the cupcake of the mid-2000s.
Yeah, like, it got exported overseas, or it was coming from, you know, UK, and I think possibly that helped sell this.
Yeah,
project.
Sure. And what a great time to remind people that you could grind up a person. But yeah, anyway, so that's pretty much how it's set up. And from there on, they get a pretty all-star cast. Alan Rickman, the first of two movies about Alan Rickman being a powerful man who locks up a woman in a tower that we will discuss. Timothy Spall, great story. He took the role simply because his daughter really wanted to meet Johnny Depp, and he said that went so well because Johnny Depp was so nice to her that he was like, wow, that was a dumb reason to take a role, but it was really worth it.
And Spall is wonderful. Like,
he's so funny.
He's so well cast. Him, and looks the part.
Of the, like, stars that they cast, him and Sacha Baron Cohen as Pirelli, yes, are like, yeah, chef's kiss, perfect. Yeah. That's exactly who should be playing that part for stars.
And a real, this is a real first time outside of kind of the Ali G role for Sacha Baron Cohen. So I think it was a real kind of coming out of the flexibility of him as an actor.
Is Borat the same year?
Oh, just before, 2006.
Just before. So Borat's 2000. Okay, got it. So, like, he's riding on the coattails of Borat, which is interesting.
But I think this was Hollywood being like, so you're going to settle down and make, like, normal movies, right? Like, that was kind of the expectation for
him. He's so handsome.
And, and his, I think that's also a thing. Nobody knew that he was so handsome. But it's also his big thing, which unfortunately never came to pass, was a Freddie Mercury movie. So I think he also was really eager to flex his chops.
He's an actor who sings, and that's one of those things that I think people don't really understand the difference between a singer and an actor who sings, and that's exactly what he is, and he's very good at it.
And it's worth saying Sondheim, because Sondheim was heavily involved. Like I say, he hates most of his 60s and 70s adaptations, so now he is heavily involved. And one thing Sondheim says, which is a criticism people lob at this movie, is the singing is not quite up to his crazy singing standards.
I have big problems with Helena Bonham Carter, specifically because I think she misses a lot of the jokes.
She plays it really crestfallen more than evil.
The whole film is very one note for me, and that's my biggest problem with it. But we'll get to that. Cam, go ahead.
as I was saying, Sondheim says he prefers to cast actors over singers when it comes to movies. Because again, he's this guy who he thinks, like, for instance, all the songs, almost every single song has lines and stuff cut out of it because Sondheim thinks that a song cannot be as long in a movie as it is on stage.
Oh, they chop the hell out of this. This is a 3-hour long musical cut down to an hour and a half.
I think both the ones we're talking about have pretty significant cuts, but this one, this one has a full hour cut out of it, which is pretty wild.
So there is a Ballad of Sweeney Todd that explains the whole story that they that they originally, I mean, I'm sure we're going to get to this, Cam, they had originally cast Christopher Lee in this role as, like, the gentleman ghost who was going to be like the chorus, like the Greek chorus that would kind of guide us from scene to scene, which I actually don't hate that concept. But hey,
there's also a good Sondheim quote where he approves of the cut, as much as that's the weird thing is that is a great song from the musical.
It's so good.
Unfortunate. But
they cut all the catchy songs out. I think that's the biggest issue I have, is like the catchy stuff's all gone. Like God That's Good is gone. Like it's very
there's
weird.
A lot of catchy songs, Becky. There's like 10 bangers in Sweeney Todd. But Stephen Sondheim, the funny joke he says is he's like, I'm going to sit here watching the movie Sweeney Todd and them asking me to attend the tale. He's like, I'm attending the tale. How much more can I attend the tale of Sweeney Todd? But that makes me laugh. And the funny thing is also is leftover one of the ghosts with Anthony Stewart Head, who now shows up for one scene and you're like, wait, why did he? Why is he here? Why is he going? Yeah. But he was supposed to be a ghost later on. Yeah, so it's an interesting adaptation. They chose to focus also... people who love the stage musical, the young couple, they cut a lot of that out. But I think that works pretty well. Their focus was Mrs. Lovett, Toby, and Sweeney Todd. And actually, specifically, Tim Burton says his interest is more Toby and Mrs. Lovett. And that's why I think he likes, and actually it's a change that Sondheim likes as well, why he makes Sweeney Todd, like he makes him just kind of a one-note joke guy where he's so boiling with rage constantly that the joke is just that he is like not even of, they call him dead. Like Tim Burton and Johnny Depp are like, this man is already dead. He is just rage. So yeah, actually the Toby part, in my mind, I barely remember Toby from the stage musical, the little kid that they adopt when they kill Sacha Baron Cohen, who's in love with Mrs. Lovett. and ends up killing everybody, essentially.
That actor who plays him is quite good, and he looks the part.
And I think it's his first film, too. Him
yeah,
and Joanna, really, and I think even Jamie Bowles, Campbell Bowers, it's all their first films, and they're mm-hmm. great. But they do kind of seem a little different because they're stagey. But yeah, so it's an interesting adaptation. I do like the comedy of it. Like, I think By the Sea is so much funnier than it is on stage.
I was just going to say, that's the part of the film that makes me frequently rewatch this. I mean, mm-hmm. we've had it on Hollywood Suite for a number of years off and on, and we've done, you know, things with it, like a spotlight on Tim Burton and Johnny Depp stuff, and I always end up having to rewatch it, but I look forward to rewatching it, and then I'm always confused how I feel about it at the end. But that By the Sea sequence in the film with the old-timey bathing suits and that kind of, you know, 1850s, 1860s idea of vacationing in England, I love that sequence. That's my favorite sequence in the whole film.
I also like I think the kind of ironic stuff works best. So one of the reasons why John Logan continued to work on it past Sam Mendes with Tim Burton, and one of the reasons why they connected was Tim Burton and John Logan both really love the old Amicus horror movies, so stuff like, you know, mm-hmm. like Theater of Blood and like Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. So I think that they make it a lot like one of those revenge movies that's just about a crazy character taking revenge. So,
but it's not really how it was marketed. I guess that's maybe
the problem. I mean, it was literally sued for false advertising in Great Britain because it was not marketed as a musical. Yeah. Apparently it caused quite an uproar because they did not show songs.
When they were on the press junket, there was a lot of concern that teeny boppers were going to show up to see Johnny Depp and then be exposed to people having their throats slit incredibly graphically. And that's something I want to bring up too, because like Tim Burton movies are spooky, but they're not violent. And this one is like a straight up violent film. And Cam, you had an interesting thing about the blood.
Oh, yeah. So the blood is purposely. And I guess the same thing was applied. It's the same special effects people that did Sleepy Hollow. And they want the kind of surreal blood. And I think the blood is meant to look like Hammer Horror and Amicus Blood.
Agree.
It's that weird paint color. Like, and it's just like red paint. But at the same time, the sequence, like my other favorite sequence is the reprise of Joanna, where it's like this love song and he's just slashing people's throats like crazy. And apparently there's so much blood that on set, the entire crew had to wear garbage bags.
Oh, man.
Like, I mean, there's a part where it just covers the lens. They obviously were planning to just have these arterial sprays. But I think was Tim Burton's thrust. And I believe, I couldn't find the stuff to back it up again, but I swear I've heard him say that he wanted it to be black and white except for the blood. Mm. And you kind of see that in the coloring, because it's a fairly gray and grim Victorian kind of England, but except for the blood, which is so crazy. And I mean, God, it's so violent. Like, I think of the death of Judge Turpin, where instead of slicing his throat, he stabs a razor into it. It's so gross.
It's kind of a good payoff, though.
Oh, yeah. And how do you pay off having killed a bazillion people?
Yeah.
And all those bodies thudding down below.
Alan Rickman.
God, I miss him. I miss him so much.
I mean, he lived a good life, but it's just tragic that we don't have him anymore. Yeah. He is so perfectly cast in this. He's repulsive.
So gross, yeah.
But you get it. You get his desire to control young, pretty women. Like, it
breaks my heart, though, is that there's a song in the musical that I really wish they had kept in, which Judge Turpin sings, called Joanna Mia Culpa, where he actually struggles with what he is doing. And it's the first time you see him. And like Sweeney Todd's epiphany, it's that decision of like, yes, I am turning to the dark side. It's like, should I do this? Yes, I am. And it more makes the foil of him and Sweeney Todd more prominent. And I think it also makes him a more interesting and more vile character because he deliberately chooses that he is going to basically marital rape this woman.
Yeah, but I also feel like, to me, I feel like that's also maybe the difference between the stage and the screen, is like a character like Judge Turpin, you can't have a guy who like rapes a woman into insanity plus kidnaps a child plus sends a guy to Australia so he can rape his wife. It's just tough to even, like, that guy's just a mustache twirler from minute one, you know?
Speaking of insanity, I think the other sequence that is so well done, because it's really, really scary, but the idea of comeuppance is wonderful, is, you know, Joanna is sent to an asylum, and we find out that wigs are made from the hair of women committed to asylums. And there's a whole room of the blonde, bald women that they've shaved to make wigs. And they throw the warden of the asylum into that cell and all the women attack him.
Yeah.
And that is like, I don't think a lot of people talk about that sequence. And I don't know the musical the way you guys do. I am a very non-musical person, but I think this is, if I ever got a chance to see a stage production of this, I would do it in a second. This was also a ballet in the 1950s, which please bring that to Toronto when COVID is over. But that sequence, I'm not sure if it's in the musical, was really scary for me. And it's a non Sweeney Todd. Like, Sweeney Todd's not really involved in it. What do you guys think of the title sequence? Because Tim Burton is so famous for his
title sequences. I miss them so much. And the way they set up movies, and we don't do them anymore. And there's such an art to them. Like, I can't remember three quarters of Seven, but God, I love the intro title.
So this is like the Meat Pie Factory sort of sequence. It's actually done by Richard Morrison, who's a British title designer who goes all the way back to 1989's Batman with Tim Burton. He was the one which is such a beautiful title sequence where you have you don't realize that it's going to be the bat signal, but it's this excellent use of miniatures. So he came up with he's a non-CGI guy, and I think this is one of his earliest CGI title sequences. And I remember seeing this in theaters and knowing something was off just based on the CGI in the title sequence. It was like, oh, this isn't... And I do think I like this film, but I remember being disappointed in the first 5 minutes because it was an early indication that this is almost too high budget, going to be too digital. And part of the reason why we love Tim Burton so much was that, which is that tactility and that handcraftiness that is always there in his early films.
I'm there with you. But I feel like that's the same thing as in Alice in Wonderland and Big Fish. Big Fish is, I think, like really the tipping point where starts to go a little too heavy into CGI, where you start to lose the believability of it.
Yeah, like the CGI works for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which I think is the film that is the one that's right before Sweeney Todd. You know, that works. That's fantasy, like how you know, whatever. But for the Oompa Loompas and things like that, which is just that one Tamil actor, which is so wonderful. But there's something about the CGI that I wish Burton had made this film, kind of like how Cam was indicating, in, let's say, 1992.
Yeah.
Like if his initial inquiry in 1987 to Sondheim's rights had gone forward quicker, I think this would be a canonical Burton.
It would have been a very different world, because I think it would have been instead of Batman, actually, which is kind of wild.
Well, would Michael Keaton have played Judge Turpin at that point, right?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it would have been, I mean, he wanted, I don't know. He wanted Ray Liotta to be Batman, so.
What? Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. We can get into that in another episode of your film.
Sweet. 89. We'll get there. Okay. I just want to bring up super quick that a friend of mine is like a trained professional opera singer. And I went to him to ask him like, what do you think of the music? Like, I think Pretty Women is really like the strongest, like actually sung song. And so I had him go and watch. And he's like, singing is great. But I had an anxiety attack watching Johnny Depp whistle into Alan Rickman's face. And I was like, okay, that's actually pretty funny how we watch movies this way. But let's talk about a movie that actually does have that like homemade, hand-spun feeling. Both the original and the adaptation of it have that same sort of homespun feeling. And before I rewatched it for the podcast, I had to like really time when I had available brain space to have a song stuck in my head because I knew You Can't Stop the Beat was going to be in there for frickin' days. It is, of course, based on 1988's John Waters' film Hairspray, which is arguably also his most family-friendly film, and it's autobiographical. And that it deals with his love of regional dance shows, which we're going to get into. And Hairspray was this movie that it did incredibly well on Broadway. And movie studios were just salivating to make it and get it right. In fact, I wanted us to hear Adam Shankman right now because he's got a great story about how the job came to him and the big deal that this was.
I had just been hired to direct the new film adaptation of the musical Hairspray. And what with the rabid fan bases of the original John Waters version, the phenomenon that was the Tony-winning Broadway musical, and the extremely high hopes from the studio, they were gunning for me like I was a new media residual check at a Writers Guild negotiations meeting. Nightmare. In fact, all that my new boss, Bob Shea, said to me was, and this is the truth, congratulations, don't get up.
So, Alicia, you love this movie. I love this movie. Let's talk about Hairspray.
Yeah. So this is 2007's Hairspray, which, you know, the Broadway production comes about in 2002. So it's not that long after the Broadway production premieres. And it was, like you say, a huge hit and definitely funded John Waters for many, many years. He's very appreciative of that. I will flag myself as a giant John Waters fan, like contemplating a tattoo, but can't decide what specific film to somehow impart on my body.
Pink flamingos. Just, yeah, you could just get flamingo. A pink flamingo and you would know. You would know.
I thought about a big lobster from, the Maniacs. What is it? I can't remember which film it is. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We won't get into my tattoo fantasies. Yeah, so this is much more an adaptation of the musical than a remake of the 1988 film. The film in 1988 isn't a musical.
No.
Not traditionally. Like, there are a lot of rock and roll sequences and a lot of dance, but no one really starts singing in the 1988 version, which, of course, stars the incredible Ricki Lake in her feature film debut, and John Waters's, you know, partner in crime, who very, very sadly would die just a few weeks after the premiere in 1988 of Hairspray. So it's very much, it's the film version of the musical. So I want to keep that really separate, because I think a lot of John Waters diehards that I surround myself with really dislike this 2007 version. And for me, I do like it, but I've had to really parcel it out.
It's The Shining, the book versus the Kubrick, The Shining. I get it.
Mm-hmm. That's a great analogy, actually. Most famously, this film is probably well known for casting John Travolta as Edna Turnblatt, the role that Divine created in 1988. And of course, John Travolta is a dancer, which we've talked about on the show in the past. Not necessarily a singer, but we're going to hear him sing, and certainly not an overweight person.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he's also not a woman. In case any of you stay. One of the things he is not. And so this is him in, for lack of a better term, drag, wearing a fat suit, which caused quite a bit of controversy.
But I mean, weirdly, that's the reason why so many of these actors like Paul Dooley and Michelle Pfeiffer agreed to be in this film.
I wasn't sure I would take this movie until I heard what John was going to be doing in it. And I said, how can I not take a job where I can be on the set watching him sing and dance and drag?
I knew that John was playing this part when I took the role, yes. I thought it was such perfect casting. It was really exciting.
The film is a kind of set, it's set in 19, I believe it's 1963. And so it's really in the background of the civil rights movement. Something important to kind of note is we don't get a Supreme Court decision on miscegenation until 1967 with Loving versus Virginia. So when you have a white character in Hairspray and a black character in Hairspray in a romantic relationship, it would have actually been illegal. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about teenagers, actually. So there's a lot of import to the background story of this, but it takes place around a local musical dance show that was kind of modeled off the Buddy Dean Show, which was broadcast in Baltimore from 1957 to 1964. And Tracy Turnblatt is this confident, we would say overweight. She's quite overweight, but confident, loving person who believes that she could be just as popular and famous on this dance show as this kind of white supremacist, terrible teenager named Amber, and her evil, evil mother that's played by Michelle Pfeiffer.
Who has the best name, Velma Von Tussel. Like, they keep the original names from the John Waters movie, and John Waters has the best names.
Yeah, and of course it's going to be slightly Germanic or like Scandinavian, just to give you an indication of her bearing. But in that original role, the one that Michelle Pfeiffer plays is actually Deborah Harry in the 1988 film. And Christopher Walken is Tracy's father. He's wonderful in this, reprising the role that Jerry Stiller did in the original.
And Jerry Stiller also shows up in this as well.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, he's got a great cameo. I do love this film. It's okay. If the 1988 version of Hairspray looks like a Diane Arbus photograph come to life, then the 2007 version is very much High School Musical come to life. And of course, we have Zac Efron as the heartthrob. And I think he's quite good in this, actually.
He's coming directly off. Like, he was not what he is now. He was coming off High School Musical. He was still Disney kid.
Same year as High School Musical, too.
Yeah.
So it's not, he's not even done High School Musical yet. There's one more to come.
Yeah. He very controversially, through his agent, with his family support, turned down the international tour of High School Musical, like the live show that occurred after the film, to do this film because he felt it was very important to him and he liked the 1988 version. I have a lot of respect for Zac Efron. He has made, you know, we have now 13 years beyond this film we're talking about. He's made some very interesting career choices, in my opinion. I will cite the Paperboy by Lee Daniels, and I will cite Beach Bum. Go out and see those insane Zac Efron.
What about him playing Ted Bundy? Should we talk as like relatable heartthrob? Like that's a whole.
I also highly recommend his current weird travel show where he just seems to have an existential crisis every episode.
Didn't even know about that.
And seems to not want to act anymore.
But
there's a part where he eats a bowl of pasta and essentially says, this is better than acting. Like, I never want to look good again. I just want to eat pasta.
I think there's a lot. There's a lot of fetishistic trash in the 1988 version. Even though this is the John Waters family film, it's still really gross. Like the 1988 version, and that fetish is missing in 2007. But that's okay.
Yeah.
If we're going to get a 2007 version of Hairspray that we wanted to be exactly like the 1988 version, then just get John Waters to make an update. Yeah. You know, you don't need that. So this, I like seeing the trajectory of where Waters has, and he always, in his books, I read every book that he writes, and he writes one at least every other year. You know, he really attributes a lot to what Hairspray has provided him and this popularity and this mainstreamness that he never thought he would achieve and never wanted to achieve, but nonetheless has provided him a lot of benefit and added a lot of benefit to his collaborators, the Dreamlanders, many of which almost all have passed away. I think Meek Stoll's still alive. Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is a great film for like a kid who really loves musicals. You could watch this.
So my question is this like the gateway drug? Like I talked about Rocky Horror Picture Show being the here's the weird midnight movie crowd. This is like the here's John Waters. You want some weird shit? Here you go.
I think it could be. We should mention Queen Latifah is fabulous. As Motormouth Maybelle. And that's one of, I think, and apparently Aretha Franklin wanted the role, but they went with Queen Latifah, which I think is the right choice.
She also wasn't in great health at the time. That was part of the thing. That was the beginning of her health problems. So I don't think they could get her insured.
So this is, you know, the songs are very catchy. I think John Travolta gives it his all. And I like how they transformed Edna's character in this. Edna, you know, the divine character in 1988 isn't as emotionally fragile as John Travolta's character is. You know, they were very clear that John Travolta's character as Edna Turnblatt has not left the house in like 20 years. She's very mortified by her weight. She's kind of has some mental health issues that you don't see in 1988. And so when she's empowered by her daughter to realize that she is beautiful, and much like how Tracy is confident and believes in, you know, integration and is going to put herself out there, she kind of influences her mother to do the same. And it's just a nice moment for me.
And that's also worth saying that is, some of that is a change from even the stage musical.
Yes.
They switched it quite a bit, the Edna stuff, which is interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting choice. They also very much beefed up the Velma Von Tussle role. The song she has with Christopher Walken is not in the musical. It's Edna and the father.
So, Cam, we didn't discuss it in Sweeney Todd, but you mentioned one of the reasons why, and I love this hot take, people don't like Sondheim as a movie musical is because there's no dancing, which I actually am on board with this. I think it's a very clever take. This one is all dancing, and it is.
This dance is wonderful.
It's awesome dancing, and Adam Shankman is a choreographer. He's a choreographer slash director, and he had worked previously with Queen Latifah.
Slash dancer.
I am a big Adam Shankman fan. I gotta say, his work is really. I think he's very good at figuring out how to translate movement onto film in a way a lot of other directors can't do. Like the angles he shoots are amazing.
I think he's a throwback to the 1950s. I don't think people know how to do that, and he is why we're talking about musicals as being popular in the 40s and 50s. It's a lost art, and he really brought it to this film.
Part of how they did that is they rehearsed the heck out of this thing. Like they rehearsed it like a Broadway musical, and Zac Efron was like, I was coming off High School Musical. I thought I could do this. He's like, this was next level bananas. They were in rehearsals for like 8-9 hours a day, just running these spots all the time. But they also rehearsed them with fake cameras so they would know where the angles were of where the camera was going to be and how. So they actually shot for edit, which is incredible.
Yeah. you can see that that's, yeah, the camera movement stuff, I think, is also very old school, and in a way that a lot of modern musicals don't. He's an interesting guy, and if you look at a lot of his dance background, it's pretty cool stuff. I recommend looking up the 1990 Oscars Under the Sea performance, where he is one of the dancers, which is funny. He's also a rare director where if you Google him, one of the first photos that comes up is him jacked and shirtless.
Wow.
Which is unusual. But yeah, no, he has, and I mean, he's done the dancing for like almost any, he choreographs any kind of non-dance films dancing. So like Addams Family Values, Boogie Nights.
Oh my God. Did he do the Thanksgiving sequence?
Yes, he did. That is exactly what he was credited with, is the Thanksgiving play. So yeah, if you think of a fun dance thing, he choreographed it or was on set consulting. So it's like
new respect for him.
Yeah, as much as I don't always love his movies, he also officiated the wedding of Freddie Prinze Jr. and Sarah Michelle Gellar, which is a pretty good fact.
That's wonderful.
Because he did all the dancing on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh my God.
So yeah, he's a very unusual guy. And I think that, and it's also, I think, a great showcase. Mark Shaiman did all the music, who now does everything. But
yeah, the songs are amazing.
He's like, yeah, he's a very funny music writer. And especially since we've lost many of those people, again, from the 80s and various places. But it's, again, I don't think you'd get a better version. I would like I think people often overlook the fact that Divine is kind of also like a fat icon.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's what 1988 was. And I think the stage musical, the Edna role was Harvey Fierstein, who's not fat.
He's a larger man, we'll say that. Yes.
So I think it's hard to sell that in the fat suit. But John Travolta is having a hell of a time and having a great time. And it's funny. And I love the accent.
Oh, the accent.
He leans so hard.
The accent. He's the only one doing it.
Yeah.
And of course, when he was on Oprah, he had to talk about the accent because, of course, Oprah also spent some time in Baltimore.
My arm's on.
Your arms on.
You and all go out for a coke later.
Go out for a coke. Yeah. How did you perfect that?
Well, it was a fight at first because I think that that everyone was frightened of the accent because maybe it wouldn't be understandable or perhaps it would be too eccentric or something.
Yeah.
And I said, but it helps me because it's slightly feminine. It's funny.
Yeah.
And it helped me be Edna.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really good. Coming back to Divine, the other thing to note that's not in this version is Divine plays a double role in 1988. So he's both Edna and then the super racist owner of the television station that the dance, as a man. I realize we probably have a lot of listeners who do not live in Toronto, but maybe they visited.
Sure.
In the East End, one of my favorite places in Toronto, which I hope survives COVID, is Gail's Snack Bar, which, Google that, Gail's Snack Bar, which serves as the Turnblatt apartment and the Hardy Har joke shop that Tracy's father runs. There's so much Toronto in this film, and it's actually the year they were filming this in 2006 is the year I moved here. And I remember, you know, hearing that John Waters was in town because, of course, he has a cameo and that, you know, they're going to make Toronto look like Baltimore. And I think they did an incredible job of that. And then also I was really obsessed with vintage clothing in that era of my life. And I couldn't get anything because the costumers of this film had rented every single dress of that era for all of their extras. And eventually they would be returned. And I've bought a couple and I can spot them like in parts of in the backgrounds of some of the sequences in the film. But this is it's a great Toronto film.
There was a really wide search for who would play Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know pretty much every woman of size who's in musical theater I know from across Canada tried out. And actually quite a lot of them were cast in various background roles as singers and dancers and quite a lot in that Jerry Stiller sequence. So I know that, and that even people who had been Tracy in stage versions were a part of it. So that's like a very cool thing. Mm-hmm. I know it was a very exciting moment when everyone was like, who will it be? Who will it be?
The actress that they cast, they found at a Cold Stone Creamery, which is a American strange, I think it's bankrupt, a very strange, maybe it was a marble slab, one of the two, a very strange ice cream shop.
Nikki Blonsky, who unfortunately the rest of her career then revolved around her weight, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, but she rolls with it. She's a very funny internet presence. She always calls herself Nikki Blonsky from Hairspray, which makes everybody laugh. And it's an interesting time. Like, I mean, you can talk about quite often these musicals when they transfer everybody's like, oh, you got to get the real people. But this one was funny because Marissa Jarrett Winokur, who did the role on Broadway, was like 30.
Hey, if I'm just saying, if Diana Ross can play Dorothy at 33, why not? Yeah.
I think we established she cannot.
Yeah.
I do think that the fun thing is that there's a lot of throwaway jokes. I think it's very rewatchable because so much of the jokes are these background silly things, just like her dancing around in a teacher's lounge that's so full of smoke. Or I just noticed this time at the end when they expose Velma von Tussle, it's because Christopher Walken has paid off the cameraman with a giant bag of whoopee cushions.
Yes.
Which is just
I think there's so a scene where they're walking on the street. It's at the intersection of Dundas and Roncesvalles, and they go past a bar and there's a bunch of pregnant women drinking and smoking.
Yeah. Welcome to the 60s musical number.
Yes,
it's fabulous.
To the 60s,
Those little moments are what I think, because I think it's like, oh, is this pretty flat? But there's a lot of that stuff. And I mean, like, the fact that it's like the fun spinning newspaper at the start is just miserable news about it's like segregation. And you're like, oh. Yeah.
I really like this film. I know it's not the best. I'm not saying that it is, but, you know, I've seen it a number of times. And I, rewatching it for this podcast, I had a smile on my face the whole time. It's worthwhile, I think.
Even just go watch that You Can't Stop the Beat segment. Oh, yes. That thing is incredible.
I was going to say, like, compared to Sweeney Todd, which we can split hairs over that music, this is pretty much, that's all amazing.
Yeah. Songs. And different genres, too. Like,
nailed.
You've got, like, 60s girl groups. You've got, like, these, like, soul songs. You've got your typical poppy 60s stuff. Like, we didn't even talk about how great James Marsden is. This is Corny Collins. And we don't have time. I mean, everybody is perfectly cast in this. And they're all
Amanda
amazing.
Bynes.
Amanda Bynes
is Penny Singleton.
Like, one of her
so
great,
good.
And one of her last roles, I think, as well, which is a little sad. But
I love her in this so much.
Yeah, she's super good. I mean, what's her name? Brittany Snow as Amber. Mm-hmm.
Jane Eastwood shows up. I'm a big Jane Eastwood fan. I adore her.
Yeah.
And she's in this as well.
Yeah. I mean,
so
Paul Dooley playing the other divine part is very funny. It's all very silly.
Exactly.
I remembered the tattoo. It's the lobster from Multiple Maniacs, which is one of the rarer John Waters that Janice
of course
somewhat
you would get
recently
the rare
restored.
One.
Which you will eat wearing a sleeveless tuxedo and putting your foot in someone's crotch. So that is where we're going to end this episode. I want to say thank you so much to the fabulous Alicia Fletcher.
Thank you. And just to, for people who did not listen to the Flashdance episode, that is what Becky was referring to with the sleeveless tuxedo and me putting my foot in someone's crotch while eating lobster. Yeah.
I already didn't know what she was talking about.
It's been a while since we recorded that one. Cameron Maitland, thank you so much.
Thank you for remembering.
I do my best. That's what I can do. And we're going to be doing our final episode of season one coming up in 2 weeks. You're going to want to join us for that because we're going to watch a movie that the writer-director wrote 3 chapters of a fictional novel that we only ever see the cover of in his movie. We're going to talk about that as well as Violent Swans. That's coming up in 2 weeks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to chat with us and find more great content? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. The home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. Uncut and commercial-free on 4 HD channels and on demand. Learn how you can subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Kevin Lipset. Until next time.
If you want to be famous, learn how to take blood out of car upholstery. That's a skill you can take right to the bank.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.